Thanks for listening to the Best of Coast to Coast podcast. And if you want to hear more than just this highlight from the show, become a Coast Insider and you can listen to the complete program, plus recent episodes about out-of-body experiences, the scientific search for extraterrestrial life, and biblical prophecies, which may have foretold our current state of global turmoil. So head on over to coasttocoastam.com and sign up for Coast Insider to catch up on what you may have missed from Coast to Coast.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
Jonathan, why with all this great technology that we possess, haven't we been able to break that and really communicate electronically with the other side? And I'm not talking about capturing EVPs or anything, but direct communication.
Well, I know there are people working on that. I don't know how that would work and if it works and stuff. There are people right here in Boulder that I know, like Mark Macy, who work on that, and I'm just not up to date on how that would function. I know Gary Schwartz, I believe, I heard at the IONS conference, is supposed to be coming out with a device very soon. I mean, I hope that something like that is possible. What I suspect might be a catalyst that may greatly increase people's awareness of that we're not limited to our bodies is just off-the-shelf virtual reality hardware that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
With the right software, I am convinced that we could create out-of-body experiences on demand in a great many people. Because if you've ever put on a VR headset, like I put on one where they simulate you're walking up to like the edge of a cliff, it's able to profoundly affect your proprioceptive sense of where your body is. So, for example, they've been using these devices on people with phantom limb pain and curing them of it. So if somebody wanted to write code for a VR headset to displace your sense of location in your own body, I think that could trigger an out-of-body experience. And then if you have enough people having that experience, I think it could really shift everything. So we really don't know where the technology, technological breakthroughs will come through. It could be, I mean, Edison was trying to work.
He tried a long time ago, that's right.
Right. I mean, I do believe, and I've had experiences that strongly suggest that, that we're talking about people on the other side, they are subject to physics as well. It's just a different physics. And some of the most profound books on this subject, one that you could read for free online because it's out of copyright, is called The Unobstructed Universe by Stuart Edward White. People can find that on Project Gutenberg. Stuart Edward White was a friend of Teddy Roosevelt and a successful author of like boys' adventure stories and travel books and so forth. And his wife, Betty, was an extremely talented medium before she died. And they were doing impeccable research into spiritualism. They were kind of at the tail end of the spiritualism movement in the 30s and 40s, and were up on the latest quantum mechanics and relativistic physics and everything. It was very, very sophisticated intellectual people. And then as soon as Betty passed, and she had already had contact with a group of entities she called the Invisibles, she was able to almost immediately speak through a medium that had been known to her when she was alive, named Joan, and was immediately able to offer every kind of veridical information. When Stuart would ask Joan, and Betty speaking through Joan, information known only to the two of them, she immediately was able to give all this detailed information and information that wasn't even known to anybody present in the room. And then Betty was able to, consulting these spirits she called the Invisibles, offer a physics for the afterlife, and with the most detailed and consistent, logically consistent explanations of how time is different over there than here, and so forth. So it is not, I don't think it is out of the question at all that we could have a technology that would greatly enhance our ability to communicate with the other side, because that is how we started our talk today, is that the spiritualism movement was born with the birth of telegraphy. There may be a communications technology on the horizon that is just about to come into being that's actually going to allow that communication to happen in an on-demand kind of way, and that will be a singularity in itself. Everyone is expecting AI to be the singularity, but if we could communicate to the 80 billion people on the other side, that would be an advancement for our species of an unparalleled sort. I mean, think of all the wisdom and knowledge and technology that may exist on this other side, and there are many different accounts that make that claim. I'm trying to be cautious about what I say so
sure.
that I am not, you know, insulting people who are wary and who are true skeptics.
But it is fraught with a lot of frauds, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is part of the history of the paranormal, and it goes back to the Aboriginal times. Many shamans were very trickster-like and would use fakery. And the Fox sisters, at the birth of spiritualism, one of them, you know, years later, said that there was a lot of what they did was fraudulent, but the other two sisters said that most of it wasn't. And my guess would be that, and this happens with a lot of people with paranormal talents, is that they have a genuine experience and genuine abilities, but then when it becomes their livelihood and the source of all their attention and so forth and identity, then they will start to fake it. But this is part of the nature of the paranormal, is that, as my friend George Hansen pointed out in his seminal book, The Trickster and the Paranormal, the trickster really governs the paranormal, the archetype of the trickster. It is anti-hierarchical, in that the person with paranormal access and ability could be somebody who's poor and is not connected to the elites, like the Russian peasant Rasputin, who had tremendous paranormal abilities and had a powerful effect on the family of the Tsar. So it crosses like these expected social boundaries, and therefore, according to George Hansen's theory, the more complex a social organization is, the more anti-paranormal it will be. So you have hunter-gatherer tribes; they're very very friendly to the paranormal. They have institutionalized it with a shaman. But then you have, say, the Catholic Church, even though the religion is based on paranormal experiences, like, Jesus walking on the water and coming back to life and people talking to burning bushes and so forth. But a 1990s Catholic catechism said interest in the paranormal, talking to the dead, all this kind of stuff is profoundly anti-religious, this 1990s Catholic document says. Why should it be anti-religious? Well, the answer, I believe, is because the religion has rigidified into an institution, and it wants things to be stable. It doesn't want new miracles and new things. I kind of, like, turned against my own, to a certain extent, my own Reform Judaism, which was very liberal and intellectual, when I went to Sunday school as a child, and they told me, the age of miracles is over. And I immediately felt the falseness of this, because I had already had my own miraculous experiences. And where does it say that in the Bible, that there's an expiration date on miracles?
There better not be, huh?
Right. The reason was they wanted the weird and the paranormal safely in the past. So the more complex a social order is, the more it doesn't want the disruption of the paranormal, and it becomes hostile to it. On the other hand, absolutely, as you started to say, there is a tremendous amount of charlatanism and trickery involved, because these are experiences that famously cannot be produced on demand. So you have a sort of a very transgressive field, though there are many people who have, the scientific methodology in most paranormal research is much better than average paranormal research. When British biologist Rupert Sheldrake looked into it and did a kind of meta-analysis of paranormal research versus regular scientific research, the paranormal research that used at least double-blind methodology, if that was like at 85%, where in regular science experiments with human subjects, it was maybe only 25%. Or Garrett Modell, that I met a few times here in Boulder, who was a physicist and engineer at Colorado University, and I mean, he does triple-blind experiments. So you do have people who are doing extremely rigorous scientific methodology in paranormal research, but a lot of people don't know about it. It doesn't get funded. there aren't very many of them, because you can lose your academic career in many cases by expressing an interest in these subjects.
Well, it's like a scientist saying that he believes in UFOs. It haunts them.
Exactly. And so this just as the Catholic Church is anti-paranormal, the organization that is even more organized than the Catholic Church is science. And so you have scientism, where you have an irrational antipathy to these paranormal phenomena, which are easily, there are many highly reproducible experiments that demonstrate psi effects. And yet there is an emotional agitation, an irrational prejudice and antipathy to the paranormal. I know when Rupert Sheldrake came out with his book, A New Science of Life, I think it was the editor of the journal Nature, said the book should be burned.
Jeez.
And he said that...
I thought those days were gone, huh?
He said that Sheldrake should be put down, just as Galileo was, and for the same reasons. I mean, it was amazing he would say this, because he was speaking as if he were the Pope, castigating Galileo, who, of course, turned out to be right.
He was right. That's right.
So you have this intense, irrational antipathy in the pseudo-skeptical movement. And I say pseudo-skeptical because they don't even know the meaning of the word. The skeptics were Greek philosophers who believed that their powers of thinking and observation, skeptic is just a Greek word that means to investigate, they believed that their ability to investigate was improved by not reaching conclusions. So you'll have a pseudo-skeptic say, oh, I'm a skeptic about near-death experience. I think it's just an oxygen-starved brain. This is the opposite of skepticism, as Dr. Raymond Moody has pointed out, because you start with a conclusion based on no research, because the oxygen-starved brain idea is easily disconfirmed, and you don't do any actual investigation. So most people who call themselves skeptics are actually the opposite of skeptics.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern, and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.